Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
News. It's big business, not just in terms of profit for news providers, papers, internet services, TV and radio, but in the power that it has to reorder our priorities. News services tell us when to worry, what to worry about, when to celebrate, sometimes even how to do these things. Philosopher, lecturer and author Alain de Botton has forsaken the balmy UK spring to come to Australia to ask us to think more about the power we give our news providers in a new book, The News, A User's Manual. Alain, thank you so much for joining us on Open House. Why a book on news?
I think that the news is in a way the thing that creates our sense of what's real, what's important, what's right and wrong. It dominates our vision of kind of reality to an extraordinary degree. You know, when we think about what Australia is something that was created by the news in terms of in our imagination. Now, the news will tell us what how Australia's doing. We've surrendered a huge part of our imagination and analysis to the news machine. And that's why I think that living in the modern age almost requires a capacity to be self-conscious about what the news is doing to our minds and how it functions.
When did you start to pay an intentional attention to news?
Look, I came across a fascinating quote by the German philosopher Hegel, where he says that a society becomes modern when religion is replaced by news, and when people stay at home on a Sunday, don't go to church, and instead read the newspaper. And I thought, oh, how fascinating. Well, we're definitely at that point in many modern societies. Definitely put Australia in there. In other words, religion used to form our sense of the most important news. You know, think of the way that, you know, Christian missionaries would bring the good news of Jesus' ministry to the world. Nowadays, it's not the good news, but the news is something that, you know, the ABC has dreamt up. So we've shifted from the idea of religion as news to man-made, recent events as news.
In the writing of it, did your own perceptions of the world through the news editor's lens change?
I think I became, I felt more empowered, really. I felt that by understanding more about how the news machine works, I, as a consumer of news, could be a little bit more self-aware. It's like the difference between someone who's been used to eating without really thinking about what food and where it's come from and how it's made and what it might do to them. You know, shifting from that to a more conscious dietary kind of regime. I felt it was empowering. And, you know, I've got children who are just growing up and starting to figure out the news in their lives. And I think for many parents, it's like you don't really know how to explain the world of news. And I'm sure I wrote the book partly not for them as children, but for them, you know, when they're a little bit older, of how it is that one can grow up safely into being a sort of adult news consumer.
I wasn't a father when 9/11 transacted, but there is a generation of children who have been scarred not by watching the vision, but by watching the way their parents reacted to it.
That's really interesting. I think many parents don't know how to present the news. It's not so much that bad stuff happens in the world, because, you know, that could be okay. It's more how the news frames it, the way, you know, my son said an interesting thing to me. He's 7, and there'd been a terrible train crash. And the next day, there was a picture of the Princess of Cambridge, Prince William's wife, Kate Middleton, on the front page. And he said, what about the train? What happened to all those people who were killed? And I said, oh, well, the newspaper just thinks that happened yesterday. And he went, but I would feel very sad if the train had crashed yesterday. Wow. I wouldn't forget. And, you know, that's a child's mind working there. But it's useful to remember how weird we are with the agenda that keeps changing. This isn't necessarily normal, and it doesn't do our inner lives, our psyches, much good. You know, we suffer, I think, when things are not resolved, not tied up, move too fast. The news tells us very important things, but often doesn't do it justice. And it leaves us with a background of anxiety and irresolution.
Elaine, it's important that people buy the book, so we're not going to disclose all of the secrets within its covers, but let's touch on some of the broader subjects. For instance, the news conversation around politics. You make a case for bias and censorship within the news.
Well, it's interesting. Bias has got a really low name in news gathering, and the idea is that the smarter your news organization, the less bias it should have. That's because we're thinking always of bad bias, bias in the interest of very narrow, kind of corrupt ideology, often of the extreme right or the extreme left. I simply make the case that unbiased news, in other words, merely facts, can be really hard to get your head around. If you're told just a plethora of facts about an issue, it can be really hard to weigh up whether it's important, significant, whether it matters. And I think some of the most successful news organizations know how to put an angle on their material. It's not that they're trying to delude their listeners, because most of us are very clever at spotting bias that we don't like. We can smell it and we run away from it if we don't want it. It just helps you to know what's important here, what matters here. You know, if I said to you, you know, President Obama is currently weighing up whether to approve of a laying down of a oil pipeline between the tar sands of Canada and the Gulf of Mexico, and I simply told you that story factually, you'd have a really hard time working out, well, what do I think? What do I think about this pipeline? Is it a good idea or a bad idea? You need, in a way, some bias, a bias in favor of, I suppose, national flourishing, intelligent analysis, etc. But you need that. You need a spin on the facts. The facts aren't enough. And I think that there's some confusion in news organizations, particularly, for example, the BBC, that will say, we can never, ever tell you what anything means. We can only tell you what it is and, you know, the facts surrounding an issue, which leaves a lot of people just thinking, I don't know what I should think about this. You know, is it good? Is it bad? What does it mean?
So by definition, then, must a news service actually cover all the biases? Let's take that pipeline for a moment. You spoke about national growth. The counterpoint to that will be that forests will be cut down and there will be a depletion of the Earth's resources. Should a news service provide all the biases in the coverage of the story for a complete perspective?
Look, that can be useful, although, you know, I think one of the news outlets that I think is very good is The Economist, the British magazine, which is global now. Now, that's a very biased magazine indeed. Most of the news stories there are heavily biased towards a kind of right-wing economics and liberal social policy. Now, when you read that, you don't have to agree with the whole thing because you know what the bias is. It just helps you. It's like a mirror that helps to sharpen your own kind of sense of yourself and what you might think. You don't have to follow its lead, but it's quite good to know what that lead is. In a way, there can be something particularly confusing about news that refuses to tell you what it thinks. And there's a kind of, there can be a disease of that almost in serious news organizations with lots of very clever journalists who've got unbelievably rich opinions who can't express any of them for fear of unduly influencing the audience. And that seems peculiar in an age when really what we need is not more facts, but the meaning of those facts somehow elucidated for us.
In the coverage of politics in this country, and I suspect more broadly around the globe, there's a fascination in forensic detail of the ugliness, the foibles of our politicians, their falls from grace, their corruption, and there are a couple of very big cases dominating the headlines in this country right now on that very theme.
I think if you open the heart of any journalist, you'll find inscribed on it Watergate. The Watergate scandal is still the number one obsession with journalists. And let's analyze what Watergate means. Watergate is an event where some journalists uncovered skullduggery in the highest levels of politics, a few rotten apples, and it was able to investigate and bring down a government. And this is such an obsession of modern journalists. Still today, the Watergate paradigm is operating, and people are looking for, the next Nixon, you know, everywhere. The problem is that many of the issues that are really facing our nations are not necessarily those that are the responsibility of a rotten apple who can be neatly bundled into a police van after a kind of James Bond-style journalistic investigation. Often the facts are out there already, and what they require is simply people to make them vivid and alive. We need to get away from this idea that the most secret things are the worst things. And in other words, if you move away from secrecy, you're dealing then with things that are absolutely fine. There are real problems around things like climate change, and everybody knows the information on climate change. It's not a secret at all. There are issues around education, social policy, schooling, etc. These things are not secrets. It's just they're lacking journalism that can get to grips with the underlying issues and make them interesting to a wide audience. So I think we sometimes get carried away with, you know, police fan journalism, the handcuffs around the powerful politicians. It's mesmerizing, and for many journalists, that is why they went into journalism. But I think it's slightly naive and slightly theatrical. It's like, let me bring down three bad politicians and the nation will improve. The things that are wrong with the nation are often slipperier. They're not the work of three bad people somewhere.
Elaine, in the news, the book, you also countenance our emphasis on foreign news in so much as there's not enough of it. How did you start to form your view about the appropriate amount of foreign news that should be in our news coverage?
Foreign news, it tends to focus in on the disasters. It parachutes you into a place, Bolivia, Peru, etc., when there's a landslide, a coup, etc. And it then expects that the audience back home is going to care a lot. So huge resources are spent sending journalists to these places and then expecting that the audience at home will care. And then, of course, the extraordinary thing happens. No one cares at all. Mm. If you look at web traffic figures for these stories, no one cares. We just want to hear about, you know, what Kylie's doing. So does that mean that we're horrible people, racist people? No. I think what it means is that we have a very hard time caring about people who we're introduced to simply through data, simply through facts, at the most catastrophic moment of their lives. If somebody tells you 300 people have just died in a faraway land about which you know nothing, about which you have no inner images in your mind, you don't care. How can you care? We can only care about people who we can empathize with. And the news has forgotten that one of its roles in its foreign coverage is not merely to report on the disasters. After all, it's not a branch of the Foreign Office. It's not a branch of diplomacy. It's a branch of that faculty which is trying to get us to expand our powers of empathy for people in other countries. And you can't become empathetic of people thousands of miles away if you know nothing about them other than the fact they were just died in a typhoon. That's not enough. And that's why we become very, well, I say in the book, global provincials. We are global in the sense that we know everything in theory about everywhere, and yet we're totally provincial in the sense that we don't care at all about any of it.
In your experience as a global citizen, how is Australia generally portrayed in a global foreign news perspective?
Well, in many ways, Australia, being the lucky country, escapes the news. It sort of seems as though nothing happens in Australia because the news can't see things happening unless they are given a very dramatic form. And now, luckily, in many ways, Australia has been lucky to have escaped a lot of the kind of dramas that people think of as news. Mm. So you've not had a coup. The weather of late has been at least relatively stable. No major, explosions in factories, etc., etc. So therefore, it looks like Australia doesn't exist anymore. Because there's nothing that's happened that looks like a news event. Of course, you come to Australia and you realize that Australians are leading the world in many ways, that there are all sorts of developments here that could be of deep interest to nations outside of the country. But it's very hard to get those to fit the news paradigm. So I would say that until something goes wrong, like all countries, Australia is invisible. And because not that much has gone wrong in Australia, this goes to the heart of my book, What is News?
Yeah.
Right? Now, news, I think, is information that is important to know about for the flourishing of the individual and the nation. Is there any news out of Australia? Of course. The world has got so much to learn. For example, about class. Right? Australia has solved the class problem in many ways. It's not a nation of economic inequality, of equality, but it's a nation of, in a way, in many ways, class equality. Britain has so much to learn about Australia in the area of class. It can't learn it from the news because the news doesn't see things like that, things as subtle, slippery, in a way as anthropological rather than dramatic and diplomatic.
Elaine, one of the central themes of your book is context in all things. How does context play out in economics news?
Look, ultimately, the job of economic news is to help us to understand a major part of our nation, which is, how the economic system works. We've just had recently in many parts of the world, Australia was largely bypassed by this, but the single greatest economic crisis that the world has known in the last 100 years. And the news spectacularly missed it. It did not see it coming. And when it came, it was unable to explain it properly to people. If you think of the protest movements that broke out around the world, what they were about really, in part, was the news. It was about people who had been enraged by news of the inequality and the corruption and the failures in the financial system, who were outraged by this, wanted to do something about it, but had no good ideas really about what to do about it, other than stand in a public square and shout and try and get something done. But there were very few good ideas about what actually to do. And I think the news bears some blame for that. The news does not inform the citizenry properly of the political and economic underpinnings of the nation. If you want to become a Marxist and suspicious around this, I think they've got a point that there is an attempt to, either conscious or unconscious, to leave us very unaware of how the machine really works. Yes, we know a lot about Kylie's new album. We know a lot about, you know, exactly where the airliner might have gone down or might not have gone down. Do we really understand how the country works, right? No, we are fed bits of information which give us a pseudo-knowledge of the economic and political workings, but it really is only a pseudo-knowledge.
Developing that theme, what's your perspective on the way calamities should be covered?
Look, there's a view among serious journalists that the public interest in disasters is crude and low and should be kind of ignored. And you see this in newsrooms. People go, oh God, you know, they're again interested in, you know, that car crash or whatever. Look, I'm relatively sympathetic to the human appetite for reading about disasters. But you have to ask, what are we trying to do when we're fascinated on yet another story about the disaster, etc.? What are we looking for? I think we're looking to get in touch with something that's really quite poignant and difficult, which is that all of us are mortal. All of us every day run enormous dangers. We may not make it to the evening. Something may drop on us, something inside us. We may suffer a stroke, etc. So life is vulnerable. And when we turn to a disaster, what I think is absolutely is the heart of people's fascination is when people say, it started as a sunny day, and by evening, the family was destroyed. Mm. Or the guy took the flight, he was going to see his daughter's birthday party, and now he's at the bottom of the ocean. Right? In other words, how something beautiful and innocent and everyday can turn into catastrophe. That's all of our lives. In one way or another, that's written into the narrative of our lives. We're all going to meet with some disaster. Maybe we're 92 and we're going to die in our sleep, but basically we're going to suffer a disaster that will in some ways be a surprise to our assumption that life is something that we can look forward to with confidence, lasting a long time. So we are rehearsing our own mortality through these stories. Does the news help us to rehearse these mortality? Not really, because it just stays at a factual level. It goes on and on and on about the rescue efforts, and something was found floating in the sea, and was it 100 meters long or 5 meters long, or was it a bag, or was it a seat, or whatever it was, without really going, look, guys, the reason why we're all interested is because all of us are mortal. So in other words, you want to get the kind of meta-level story out a bit more, but the news tends to stay quite factual at this level, and it leaves our emotions a little bit unresolved and undigested, which explains the sort of low-level anxiety that watching a little bit too much of the news sometimes brings.
Are you suggesting then that our newsmakers should build in a here's what you do with this story element to their coverage?
It's not a moral imperative, but it would be terribly useful to sometimes shine a light on where this piece of information might go in the viewer or the listener's heart and mind. In other words, what could I make of this? You know, think of the Sunday sermon tradition in religions. Many Sunday sermons pick up on news events, but they'll try and spin it towards, you know, the big themes of, you know, Jesus's ministry. Now that could sound quite weird to an atheist or secular person, but what the, you know, priest is trying to do there is to say, okay, things have happened, and we can relate these things to a bigger story about what it means to be human. And I think within a secular context, there could be a version of this that gets done on the news. It doesn't have to take hours to do. You can just send a little signal out to the reader that what's going on is a story that is ultimately related to, you know, you, the human being, the listener, the psychologically complicated creature, not some fictional figure that I think newsrooms sometimes imagine that their viewers are. a creature with an endless appetite for updates, with very little self-awareness, with very little awareness of what's gripping about emotional stories.
Elaine, let's move on to the ubiquitous celebrity news, in quotation marks. You believe that we're all actually fans of celebrity news. It's just a matter of who we define as a celebrity.
That's right. All societies have had celebrities at their heart. There's something in the human being that wants people to look up to take an interest in, to follow. This is a very natural and in many ways a very good impulse. We're looking to learn. But serious news organizations mock that, and they think that it's a low interest. It's like you're just interested in these, you know, boring celebrities, and you shouldn't be. It's not something to be interested in. I think the answer to the solution is not to do away with celebrity news, but to get a better kind of celebrity news, to make sure that serious news organizations get involved in the business celebrities and actually make new celebrities. After all, a celebrity is merely something, a creature that was made into a celebrity by, guess is who it is, the media. The media makes celebrities. But if the most serious news organizations in a country say that celebrity news is below them, not something they could possibly get involved with, then that will, in a way, cast doubts on the whole business of celebrity. So we need better celebrities, not no celebrities. So in other words, we can make heroes, not in the sense of some extraordinary divine figure, but the ordinary heroes that a democratic society need. People who show us how to live. People who show us how to have better relationships. People who guide us in how to operate in the workplace. People who show us how to raise our kids. We need heroes. And the better the society, the better its heroes are going to be. And the terrible problem is that you've got an Australian news organization that is worrying about the Kardashians. You want to go, look, that's taking place thousands of kilometers away. Just forget about these people. Make your own celebrities and make sure they're better.
And here we stand with our toes on the precipice of what's news and what's entertainment.
Well, again, there's this sort of highbrow view, but if it's entertaining, it's not very good news. And if it's very good news, it's probably a little bit boring. And that's fatal, right? Because all news is in the entertainment business. If we define entertainment as the ability to reach into the hearts and minds of the audience, if you're boring your audience, you've got a problem. News is a communication mechanism. It's like saying, I'm a fantastic playwright. Unfortunately, no one wants to see my plays. But that's a problem. If you take someone like Shakespeare, he knew he had to get an audience, you know, bums on seats. He got them, and he would appeal to, the fishmonger and the shoemaker and the king and the queen, and he would make sure that he seduced his audience into caring. And too often, serious news organizations don't accept the need to seduce, and they leave the business of seduction to the tabloids, who really get to grips with it. They know how to draw us in, but in the name of such trivial things. So I think in order to thrive in this kind of multi-channel age, serious news needs to learn to be more seductive, to be more entertainment, not in the name of trivia, but in the name of the highest and most important issues. Because if the most important issues are made unentertaining, you've got a real problem in a democracy. We live in a democracy. We need to interest the mass in the most important issues. If highbrow organizations abandon mass communication, you've got a real problem.
Elaine, who has the more power then in this news dynamic? Is it those who craft the story with their own individual biases? Or is it us, the user, who need to be attracted enough to the story in the first instance to engage with it?
Look, I think news organizations are terrifically powerful, but almost they don't flex their muscles properly. One of the things that news organizations do, for example, is they keep watching what other news organizations are doing in case they've missed the story. Okay, my advice is, guys, stop being afraid of missing the story. Go out there, use your own eyes and ears, make up stories. Even if no one's leading it on the 7 o'clock bulletin, you find it, you do it. The highest mission of a news organization is to get the information for Australians that they need to make a better Australia. If that's your remit, you don't have to report on the Kardashian. You could sometimes ignore Kylie, though sometimes she's very interesting for precisely that mission. But in a way, let's get back to what journalism could be, its most idealistic mission, which is to improve Australia. Is the news doing that? Only sometimes. There's a lot of room for improvement. That's fine. We're only at the dawn of the age of news. We're only just beginning to remember what it means to have good news organizations. And there's a lot further to go.
Alain de Botton, thank you so much for your time. The book is The News, A User's Manual, and it's available at your favourite outlet right now.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.